Welcome to Holden Village. In the fireside room, today's speaker is Paul Olson, speaking on the topic of African-American poetry, Liberating for All. Let's listen in on Paul.
I thought that my approach would be three-dimensional, or I'd use three different facets of literature to get this going. I have some poems that I have memorized and I can dramatize. I'd like to do a couple of those. And then I have some poems that my students wrote after seeing the NPR video or the public television video, Eyes on the Prize. Maybe some of you, maybe many of you have seen that. Well, I just showed them one section of that, the first one, and in which is the story of Emmett Till, the young 14-year-old boy who they said whistled at a white woman in the South in 1956. He didn't whistle at her, but he said something. He just talked to her, and later that night, the husband and two of his cronies came to the uncle of this kid who was from Chicago, visiting in the South, didn't know he couldn't approach a white woman, and they took him out and killed him. And then when he was at the funeral, his mother left the casket open because they had beaten him to death too, and she wanted the world to see that. And you can imagine the pain that she went through to do that. And then the three guys were tried in the South and were all acquitted. And that was one of the things that started out in this Eyes on the Prize, or the step toward the modern civil rights movement. And so that's the second thing. That is the poems I'll dramatize, the poem that these students wrote. And then a couple that I have one here to hand out that we might share and then hand back in, because our Xerox machine is precious. And I can use it again if that so happens. And then just kind of share our responses to this aspect of poetry. I mean, there's a lot of ways we could go and a lot of things we could talk about. And you can talk about whatever you want to, at least to get started. I would focus this on that for poets, seeing what's out there is different than having vision. Vision involves imagination, and then I think for all poets, but especially for African-American poets that we're going to focus on tonight, I think vision involves love, it involves faith, it involves recklessness, and involves courage, and other things like that too, kind of the noble qualities to be a prophet. And what you know about the prophets of the Bible really can stand up or stand toward the poet is too. So we're going to look at how seeing is different for the prophet and the poet's vision and what he or she can imagine. And in the first poem I'm going to do, the plot of this poem is a guy stumbles upon the remains of a lynching. And the lynching occurred months and months ago, but maybe not, and it's universal, it seems. And I might point out to you that as late as 1948 and as far north as Kansas, 11 blacks were lynched. I might point out to you that as late as 1993, the Ku Klux Klan burned crosses in a yard in as far north as Dubuque, Iowa. It goes on in Des Moines, it goes on everywhere. So the poem becomes, I think, has some universal power beyond the years that it was written somewhere in the 1930s. So the speaker of the poem stumbles upon the remains of this lynching, and just three, there are many powerful images, and I'm going to let you or ask you to speak to those images when I'm all done, but three of them to point out, just to pay attention to are, the phrase, a whore's lipstick. And just, I want to ask you at the end, what does that do to you? What does that image do? And what does it suggest that the prophet, the poet, sees? The whore's lipstick. Peanut shells. That's an image. That's all it is. Just peanut shells in line that isn't embellished at all. That's just that. What does that do to you? And greasy hemp. And then there are many others, and you might pick up more profoundly, in fact, and meaningful to you on some other images as well. But those are just three of to just catch and notice. The other thing to say about this is, some of you have seen it because I've done it at Holden. I have a one-man play that's made up of poetry, and this is from that. And I've done these poems since 1987 all around the country. And I usually don't wear shorts and a pink shirt. But the idea there is to not have any kind of costume or any kind of dress that would distract. But that's irrelevant. Anyway, I had performed this many, many times, this particular poem coming up, until one evening in Michigan, in front of a well-educated and mostly black audience, this poem changed for me. And I had always been, up until that night, the poet. And the poet is Richard Wright. He's black. I had kind of assumed his persona and been this black man stumbling upon the remains of a lynching. And that night, it was impossible for me to be black. As much as my imagination works and as powerful as the poem is to me and works on me, I couldn't do that. And I was a white man stumbling upon the remains of a lynching. And it changed the poem forever for me, and it suggests to me why the title for tonight's session, The Black Poets Speak to All of Us. I used the phrase a couple nights ago for the Holocaust literature, that how do we dare tread on this sacred, personal, powerful soil of the Holocaust, and how can a white Norwegian, American Norwegian, tread on the soil of post-slavery, of African Americans who are living the legacy of slavery. It happened to my brother. And I think I'm going to have you notice that too, that could this be you stumbling upon the remains of a lynching? And that's enough talk, and we'll see the poem. And one morning while in the woods, I stumbled suddenly upon the thing. Stumbled upon it in a grassy clearing guarded by scaly oaks and elms. And the sooty details of the scene rose, thrusting themselves between the world and me. There was a design of white bone slumbering forgottenly upon a cushion of ashes. There was a charred stump of a sapling pointing its blunt finger accusingly at the sky. There were torn tree limbs, tiny veins of burnt leaves, scorched coil of greasy hemp, a vacant shoe, an empty tie, a lonely hat, a ripped shirt, and a pair of trousers stiff with black blood. And upon the trampled grass there were buttons, dead matches, scatterings of tar and feathers. A gin flask, peanut shells, and a whore's lipstick. Scattered traces of tar, restless arrays of feathers, and the lingering smell of gasoline. And through the morning air, the sun poured yellow surprise into the eye sockets of a stony skull. And while I stood there, my mind was frozen with a cold pity for the life that was gone. The ground gripped my feet. My heart was circled with icy walls of fear. The sun died in the sky. A night wind muttered in the grass and fumbled with the leaves on the trees. The woods poured forth the hungry yelping of hounds. The witnesses rose and lived. The dry bones stirred, rattled, lifted, melting themselves into my bones. The gray ashes formed flesh, firm and black, entering into my flesh. Cigars and cigarettes glowed. The gin flask passed from mouth to mouth. The whore smeared lipstick red upon her lips. And a thousand faces swirled around me, clamoring that my life be burned. And then they had me, stripped me, battering my teeth into my throat till I swallowed my own blood. My voice was drowned in the roar of their voices, and my black, wet body slipped and rolled in their hands till they bound me to the sapling. My skin clung to the bubbling hot tar falling from me in limp patches, and the down and quills of the white feathers sank into my raw flesh, and I moaned in my agony. Then my blood was cooled mercifully, cooled by a baptism of gasoline. And like a blaze of red, I leaped to the sky, my blood boiling like water. Panting, I clutched childlike, clutched to the hot sides of death. Now I am dry bones. and my face a stony skull, staring in yellow surprise at the sun. Respond.
While I catch my breath.
I'll start you with, in the power of specific images lies the poet's vision. How does he imagine this world? It's a he in this case. I've got some she's coming up. Any image that just, boom.
Casualness of their gathering there.
And what's an image that's the great assessment of it, the casualness of this whole spectacle. And what are the images that make you know it's casual?
Peanut shell.
Isn't that, what an image. Just, it's the circus. Yeah, great. Peanut shells does that. And what I'm suggesting to you is, and what you already know, and we'll look at, is that peanut shells, the nature, just two words, that whole powerful image carries with it casualness. Carries with it, what else?
Entertainment.
Yeah,
the gin bottle.
What?
The gin bottle,
entertainment. Let's have, yeah. So it's casual. I've always told students if you get nothing out of literature, get this, that what it's most about is a reverence for life, for all life. And clearly in this poem, and that's the vision of the poet, is look at these people. There is no vision, I mean, there is no reverence for life. Go ahead, what else? Yeah.
The vision that stood out for me was the tree and the finger pointing accusingly towards
yeah.
that.
And so I don't want to act like an English teacher, but I am, so what the heck. What this sapling pointing a blunt finger accusingly at the sky. I'm not looking for anything profound, just the literal recognition of that image, and then how does it make you feel? I mean, it got you. That's the one you remembered out of all that. Now, we're going to see other people, whether we're conscious of it or not, I suspect we do too. Pointing a blunt finger accusingly at the sky.
Accusing God.
Where's God?
Where's God? The question, the great questions of that all great literature has to ask. It has to get into the spiritual dimensions of the human existence, or it can't be great poetry. That's why Doggerel isn't, you know, I'll slip out of here for a second. I love this one. The primal termite knocked on wood, tasted it, and found it good. And that is why your cousin May fell through her parlor floor today. That's kind of silly and funny, and it surely doesn't get to the depths of the human experience, so it can't be great poetry. Well, this does, and we've already asked some theological questions that thing about the, what was it again? Termite, yeah, I've already forgotten, see. The termite poem does, it doesn't do that. Okay, so it raises theological questions, come on. Pointing a blunt finger, accusing it, what else? It's a tree that does this.
Well, there's a witness too, in a sense. That's what I picked up from it. That there's this quiet, solitary witness that can be read as this guy reads the signs of what happened. There's a solitary witness there to point an accusing finger.
Yeah. Or
to point a way to look and listen.
Yeah, that's great. I never thought of that. In 8 years of performing this, I've never thought of that. The solitary witness, and here's this tree. This isn't in tune with nature, is it? This tree that's been stripped of its leaves and its tiny veins are burnt, and so is this man. And that's not how nature. One of the things black poets do often is equate there's a whole other thing, and there's a whole, we could get into it if we wanted to, a whole dimension of American literature that talks about humankind's connection to the wilderness and to nature. But the black poet often uses nature as the thing that suggests this is where freedom lies, this is where natural, I'm going to be a natural man, I'm going to be a natural woman, and the system doesn't let me be that. You know, something in this system said, you're going to die. I don't know what you did. If you're Emmett Till, you whistled at a white woman, and we're going to lynch you now. And nature doesn't like that, does it? Because that's not freedom and what else nature can do. That's great. What else?
What about the feathers in the eye? The word down, the down, which we generally associate with softness and kindness and support, wasn't it piercing his...
Yes, it was. That's a great observation. Another one I never thought of.
I love you guys. Way to go.
Yeah, it's ironic. The down and quills of the white feather sank into my raw flesh. It's not what it's supposed to be used for. All of this is out of tune. And what we're doing now, we won't stay on this forever, but what we're doing now is we're becoming conscious of the stuff that struck us. That's what literary criticism is. Literary criticism is, one of my favorite phrases, is consciousness after experience. We've had this, but I would offer that we all go about the process of literary criticism every night. I mean, we're sitting with a group of people, we just talk, or with just one person, or even your own thinking alone. You say, gee, this happened today, what do I make of that? And you develop a consciousness after the experience to be able to make sense out of it, to give it some order and some shape, and ultimately underline it, some meaning. Yeah, good. Yeah.
The fact that there was a woman there, you know, often the thing that men are involved in some of these gruesome things, but even the story about the beginning of the eyes and the prize.
Yes.
The woman went home and pled her case with her husband and said, go get
yes.
that young man, because yep. he whistled at me. The husband was at work that day.
Yeah.
So it was all on her, what she said.
Yeah. Right.
And
he wasn't there. That's a good point.
And here a woman is there.
Yeah. As if to suggest, too, that that's a great point. That evil isn't so easy to point your... Well, if we just get rid of this guy. In Richard Wright's wonderful autobiography, Black Boy, this young kid is accosted by two white men in the place where he works. And he comes in and he resigns and says, I'm going to quit. And the boss, who's from the north and is a liberal, quotes around that, says, well, tell me what they did to you. Which one of them did it, and I'll get them. Like, that's going to solve it. You know, when they get you, you're out of here now because you were a racist, and they're going to hire another guy from the south. And, we can't. It's not so easy to point our finger. It's everybody. And yeah, good. Yes.
And the image it got me is the irony of the gasoline giving him relief.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's cooling him down, and it's also going to be giving him his release.
Yep. And what was the word? Do you remember the word used for that? Maybe I didn't even say it, and I left it out.
Baptism.
A baptism of gasoline, and all that we know that that means. What are we baptized into? And the irony of that, that's great, yeah. Yeah.
That was part of what I was thinking of was hot and cold. It was he was hot, then he was cool, then he was heated again and it was cooling. It was
yeah.
kind of a constant yep. feeling this throughout there.
For sure. Yeah, intensifying that yeah, really good. Intensifying that feeling even more in the yeah.
The fact that he saw someone burned and then he got burned himself.
Yeah, the speaker of the poem himself, right, goes through all of this. And you can see, I hope now, that why I said a white man now coming upon this lynching. It can happen.
But did the audience know that switch had occurred with you that night?
That night? I don't know. I didn't announce it ahead of time. I did to you because I didn't know it was going to happen. Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. I had four pretty close black friends in the audience. And they did not comment on that, other than that was, they thought that was the most moving poem in the whole show of an hour and a half. Which, that's the reason, I think some other reason. Yeah, Tom.
Another bit of irony that struck me was the gin bottle itself lying there, both to imply sort of a party atmosphere, but then in a secondary way sort of implying, well, maybe some of these guys needed the liquid courage that it held.
Boy, what a great point. And is that ever true? Historically, in the black and white racial conflict, historically, that something, whether it's liquor or laws or traditions or pseudoscience like phrenology, something to justify their behavior. And a lot of times it took a drunk man to do that, or a drunk woman. Yeah, good. You guys are great.
I was left with the images of death, the skull, the ashes, the gray, non-life images at the time that the person himself was transformed away from all this death.
Yeah, that's a great assessment. And it makes me ask the question, then how can something, a poem like this, about death and such an awful death, how can it possibly be affirmative and positive? I had a black mother ask me once, who knew me, and at first I'm just this white honky up there teaching black lit, and then you got to kind of earn your keep, you know, over the weeks. And this black woman says, how do you teach black lit to my kids? it's so full of despair. And in this poem represents a kind of, you know, for sure, doesn't it, despair. Do you feel that way after it's all done? This is not a quiz. You won't fly. You can't fail.
Go ahead. For one thing, the speaker was transformed by the experience. So that in itself is hopeful.
Yep.
And that has... That one?
Yeah, Dan, that's the problem.
I like that. And another, to make it a little closer to theological context, and that's imposing something, but
your word is the best. The speaker is transformed. How about the audience, the reader? And how does that process work? I mean, we're getting at the heart. This is graduate level stuff, right, you guys? We should be there. How does that work in literature then, that happens? One, two, I don't remember.
I felt some despair at what had gone on, but the fact that there had been some light shined on this stuff, that had been opened up, and that we're, you know, there's a realization that we're dealing with it, at least at some level.
Yeah.
There's awareness.
Isn't that the truth? And as we unfold history, truthfully, about slavery in America and its legacy, about today Tinker Session, about treatment of the the Native Americans, the Indians, as we unfold history truthfully, that seems to be something affirmative and positive. We're finally telling the truth. Keats said it in the 19th century, truth is beauty, beauty is truth, that's all you need to know. I'm quoting him, that's in his most famous poem. Truth is beauty, beauty, truth, that's all you know on earth, that's all you need to know. But we never tell the truth. That's good.
I think the image of the surprise was what struck me, that the skull stared back in surprise still. It leaves me with the feeling that even though this has happened, it's still surprising. It's still not what we expect. It's still not what we consider to be right, normal, yeah. And even when it's happening to the person,
yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable.
That's a great assessment of that word, which I've also never thought of before. I got to take notes right after class. I write all this stuff down. The surprise, this is not normal, and it shouldn't be, and I think Wright intends that. Where did I see it? Yeah.
The phrase about the sun caught making yellow surprise in the eyes, maybe because it's repeated twice, maybe it's repeated in the poem,
yeah.
Maybe that's why it stayed with me, because I heard it twice, or maybe it's because the image that came to my head was the same God who's having this accusing sapling pointed at heaven. That same God is sending the sun down to the earth.
Staring in yellow surprise. I like that. And you know, how do you decide whether a rendering of a poem, not a rendering, I mean an interpretation or an explanation or an in-depth kind of analysis of a poem is right? And it's right if it fits the whole direction that this poem is going. And that's a great assessment too. And if somebody said, well, I think that's a symbol of the sun and the moon, and it has to do with... No, it doesn't. You can't. You know. But yours, right down the line of what's going on in the poem. It's great. Anybody else?
I was thinking about, when you said what makes things connect with people, this whole idea of surprise, that he walks into this experience that he's not looking for, but then... He had the existential thing of he sees these cigars or the cigarettes being relit and see them glowing, and that it's not this removed, isolated event that doesn't reoccur or that couldn't reoccur again. And that's where it seems to me the poet identifies in a very deep level,
yeah.
with this nobody he knows,
yeah.
but the nobody he could be.
Yeah. And all that assessment is supported by, in one morning while in the woods, I stumbled suddenly upon the thing. I just happened to be there. And in just in that stumbling, he can create all of this. He relived the whole moment, as you know. But he didn't have to think about it, didn't have to plan for it, didn't have to develop it. He just did it. And it suggests a kind of sensitivity that we experience too as listeners or readers to that. Wow, well, that's great. And Richard Wright never knew that he wrote such a great poem, because until you brought it up. Well, here's another one. And it's about abortion, and it's by Gwendolyn Brooks, and it's one of her great poems. And it's another tough one. I'll get to some later ones in a little while. And I'll let you just pick out the images here that work too. And the thing about this poem in abortion, I think that it makes sense to introduce it, is that she doesn't take a moral stand or a social or ethical stand on abortion. She just renders an experience. And the very first time I ever did this in front of the colleagues where I teach, the faculty there, I know most of the faculty, and one of the women came up to me afterwards and said, and she stands on this end, if we polarize our views on abortion, she's on this end, and she said to me, "Can you get me a copy of that poem? It's exactly where I am on abortion." And I bet it wasn't 2 minutes later, another woman came up on this end of the pole and said, "Can you get me a copy of that poem? That is exactly where I stand on abortion." And that says something about the power of the poem to render a truth about an experience without making any kind of moral or social judgment. Just to say, this is, well, let you decide. Abortions will not let you forget. You remember the children you got that you did not get. The damp, small pulps with a little or no hair. The singers and workers who never handled the air. You'll never neglect them or beat them or silence or buy with a sweet. You'll never wind up the sucking thumb and scuttle off ghosts that come. You'll never leave them, controlling your luscious sigh in return for a snack of them with a gobbling mother eye. I have heard in the voices of the wind the voices of my dim killed children. I have contracted. I have eased my dim dears at the breasts they could never suck. I have said, "Sweets, if I sinned, if I seized your luck and your lives from your unfinished reach, if I stole your births and your names, your straight baby tears and your games, your stilted and lovely loves, your tumults, your marriages, your aches, your deaths, if I poisoned the beginnings of your breaths, believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. Though why should I whine? Whine that the crime was other than mine, since anyhow you are dead. Or rather, or instead, you were not made. But that too, I am afraid, is faulty. Shall I say? How is the truth to be said? You were born, you lived, you died. It's just that you never giggled, or planned, or cried. Believe me, I loved you. Believe me, I knew you, though faintly. And I loved you all. Gwendolyn Brooks, the mother. You can be as good with abortion, or I mean the mother, as you were with Between the World and Me. Any image or phrase? Do you say that's it? Yes. Dim killed children. Dim killed children.
You never giggled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You lived, you died.
You're all like the voices in the wind.
But I knew you.
and I knew you. Let's hold for a second and look at some of these. Giggle and live and die. And what do they do to us?
Make us remember our childhood. Or...
That sure can be. That we lived and we did giggle. And yeah. In our adulthood, we did tumultuous marriages or tumultuous life and marriage and death. And we've all lived through that. Yeah. Live and die. Voices in the wind. I have heard in the voices of the wind, the voices. Glib, flippant decision. I'm pregnant. I got to get an abortion. The voices in there's forever there, haunting. The voices in the wind. Yeah, good. And the other one down there, what does that say? Can you read it? I knew you.
Though faintly.
Yeah, though faintly.
That's what I mean. Yeah, though faintly.
I knew you, though faintly.
And this whole, and it says, and I loved you all.
It's a tough line, isn't it?
Yeah. There's this whole gulf of life and experience between those.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow, yeah.
Which would, to me, speak of a person of great depth.
Yeah.
You know, to be able to sniff that out.
Why did she do it? Well, it's not in the poem. There's no way you know.
Well, the word crime did come up, which could have been, it could have been, sexual abuse.
Could have been.
That's what it brought up for me, possibly.
That's interesting, the word crime. The crime was other than the crime she committed, she says, is no other than mine. Mm-hmm. But she uses that word. And
yeah.
Sure. Did she want to do it? Does anybody remember this line? Believe that even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate. There is one of the, at least for me, one of the painful lines about human existence. We have to make decisions. And the decision itself becomes black or white, but the process of that decision is incredibly complex, but in the end, we got to decide. And all believe that even in my deliberateness, I mean, the fetus is, and then all of a sudden it isn't. That's deliberate, that's black and white. But even in my deliberateness, I was not deliberate.
Which is almost sounds like even in my choosing, I had no choice.
Yeah, yeah. So, and that leads us to why did she do this? Is she poor? Does she have, we don't know, but yeah.
And do it repeatedly.
And she's not, if that's what all means at the end, I love you all. So, yeah.
Except to me, that was a more universal kind of mother, and the all, like that could be speaking for all versions. I mean, to me, it wasn't one person.
Or when he brought up about thinking of each stage, I thought of stages. I loved you all part of your life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Every part of who you're about to be.
That's good. And all can work in all of those cases, and a good poet, not that we care now, but a good poet is going to do that, to make us have these complete responses to the word and these varied responses, because the human condition is complete and complex and varied. And all of those are true. Yeah.
I never heard in there, it might have been there, but I never heard any line that was alluding to doing the baby any favors. I mean, it was always remorseful for what the baby wasn't going to have, but there was never a hint as to why, if she's doing it for the...
It's a great observation, and why, what do we make of that? That's a loaded question, and in some ways, the focus is on her pain, the incredible complexity of the decision and the impossibility of the decision, and you know that she wasn't glib about this. I'll never wind up the sucking. You remember, put your kid to bed and you wind up the thumb and say, don't suck your thumb now. I'll never wind up the sucking thumb or scuttle off ghosts that come. There are no ghosts under the bed, David. Go ahead and go to sleep. I'll never get to do that. And she knows that. And we've all done it. I mean, and I have to ask this question in a second too, but return for a snow. Leave them controlling your luscious sigh. Aren't they beautiful? Or isn't it beautiful? Or isn't she or he? and then in return for a snack of them with a gobbling mother eye. I mean, that's the only time the kid looks good, right? You want to go back to see him. How many of you were or noticed or felt or anything, I don't know what the word is even, the fact that I am a man and the speaker is a woman? Two? And that's not unusual, but it's not unusual to have no one ever think of that. And my favorite response to that fact, because I've asked this at high school teacher workshops and so on where I've done this poem, is that I think it says something about the transcendent power of art, to transcend gender difference. And therefore, you know, and that leads me into my push for high school teachers to teach African American literature. They say, I can't teach that, I'm not black. Yes, you can. If I can read a poem by a woman.
You weren't speaking.
No, that's, well, thank you. I mean, I shouldn't have been. And I shouldn't have been. And that's the transcendent power of art, to speak to men, to speak to women. A black poet can speak to us with their vision. Yes.
When I heard that poem in your 90-minute show, and then when I heard it again tonight, neither time during the poem was I aware that there, I don't remember any mention of the father. It just dawned on me about 30 seconds ago.
No, you're right. He doesn't get to be in on this one, wherever he is. And that, I never thought of this, because that's a good observation. That's why I love to teach, because I get stuff all the time that I never thought about.
That may have been hard for deliberation.
Of course, and the solitariness of all decisions, ultimately. Ultimately.
Or fathers would be all.
Sure, could be. If that's how we read all. Right. And good. Well, let's look at one together, instead of having me do more. You have to share these. So I'll send, you know, it's like two of you per copy. There might be enough for everybody, I don't know. While those are going around, I'm just going to read to you, because they're very short, it'll take me 3 minutes. These are poems written by students, not what you have there. What I have here are some poems written by students in response to the Emmett Till murder. And when I had these along, and I was going through my box of books and junk before tonight, I thought, I think I'm going to bring some of these down, because people often ask, where are college students? I mean, are they? What are they like? Do they think? I mean, they know they think, but are they sensitive? Are their values all out the window because everybody's smoking pot and having sex in the dorm? And you know, and the answer to that is no. And just listen to these. These kids just saw. They had. I mean, it was kind of, my wife as a hospital chaplain calls it debriefing. I had to debrief them out of the power of this video of watching this kid. I mean, this wasn't a reenactment. These were live television newscasts of the Emmett Till funeral. This is how typical, I think, college kids respond. An injustice has been done. Innocence lost with one phrase. Torture, mutilation, buried with a cotton fan. He got what he deserved. Injustice. This is all Emmett Till lying in the coffin. Injustice. An injustice has been done. Innocence lost with one phrase. Torture, mutilation, buried with a cotton fan. And they got to go home. Who's right? Are you? Am I? I am, you say. I'm white. So? Is a white rose more beautiful than red? God made both. Both are beautiful. Both are right. I've read many history books and seen many programs. I've learned facts behind lynchings, beatings, and killings. I've seen pictures of depressed, run-down homes where people lived. I've learned about a young boy killed for saying hello, and then about the murderers who went unpunished. Yet the more I read, the more I see, and the more I learn, the less I understand. It's a great statement about college, and this is what should happen there. 4 minutes after class started, gotta have a poem. What to write? Gotta be connective, ought to be common. Sure wish it were good. Could write about Emmett Till's mangled face, but what? Could write about Rosa Parks, why push us around, but how? Could write about white women driving black women while their husbands burn crosses. Could write about workers laughing and walking 7 miles. That's the bus boycotts. Could write about the confused Klansmen meeting suddenly. Strong blacks. What? No fear. But how do I help it connect with other people the way it connected with me? That kid got an A. That's what he did with it. This is by a black woman that I know well, that I had in class. I don't like you, and this I cannot hide. But if you ask me straight out, I might just lie. Not because I fear you. I fear not what your evil can do, but simply because, as much as I hate to admit it, I have become very much like you. Not because I fear you, for there's nothing more that you can do. Don't fear me for who I am now, but fear me as I become more and more like you. That's a great poem, and then we'll leave it there. What it's about is the vision of the poet to see what is it that we are? What have we become? And the prophet, whether it's Jeremiah or Isaiah or Joel or Jonah, they tell us what we are. And that's what the poet does. And that's what this kid, I mean, she's not a kid, but this college student said, I've become, and I've bought into the same value structure, the faith, the same system that you have. And if you've been to any of Tinker's sessions, you know what that's about. Okay, you got a poem in front of you. Let's look at it. There's a couple of them, but we won't do them both. For RCL, the historical background for this is, in 1831, Nat Turner staged the most important and the most effective rebellion in slave history. And he and his men gathered together and eventually killed 64 women and children. And he thought that he was told by God to do this. The phrase in here, his angry stab for freedom, I want to lift up first to suggest that think what this religious man, and he was driven to for the cause of freedom. And then the poem, and then what it is that there's a journey of these people in the modern day, our day, about 30 years ago, I guess, go back to Jerusalem, the place where this, not Jerusalem, Israel, but in the south, and say, this is where it started. And they went on the same journey that Nat went on. And what the poem, I think, is about, not what it is and what you'll experience, but what it's about is the memory, the collective memory of all these people has just disappeared. And one guy says, so, he fought for freedom, you don't say. And it's nothing anymore. And 64 people were killed, all of them reluctantly, I think, in my understanding of that historical event, by these people who said, we've got to have freedom. Okay, enough. We saw a bloody sunset over Cortland, once Jerusalem, as we followed the trail that old Nat took when he came out of Cross Keys down upon Jerusalem in his angry stab for freedom 100 years ago. The land was quiet, and the mist was rising. The mist was rising out of the woods in the Nottoway Swamp. Over Southampton, the still night fell as we rode down to Cross Keys, where the march began. When we got to Cross Keys, they could tell us little of him. The Negroes had only the faintest recollections. I ain't been here so long. I come from up around Newsom. Yes, sir, town a few miles up the road. The old folks, who could have told you, is all dead and gone. I heard something sometime. I don't just remember what. Appears like I heard that name somewhere or other. So he fought to be free. Why, you don't say. An old white woman recalled exactly how Nat crept down the steps, axe in his hand, after murdering a woman and child in bed. Right here, in this here house at the head of these stairs. In a house built long after Nat was dead. She pointed to a brick store where Nat was captured. Nat was taken in the swamp, 3 miles away. With his men around him, shooting from the windows. She was thinking of Harper's Ferry and old John Brown. She cackled as she told how they riddled Nat with bullets. Nat was tried and hanged at Cortland, 10 miles away. She wanted to know why folks would come miles just to ask about an old nigger fool. Ain't no slavery no more. Things is going all right. Provided there's a good peanut market this year. We had a signpost here with printing on it, but it rotted in the hole and there it lays. And the nigger tenant split the marker for kindling. Things is all right now. Ain't no trouble with the niggers. Why they make this big to-do over Nat? As we drove from Cross Keys back to Cortland, along the way that Nat came down upon Jerusalem, a watery moon was high in the cloud-filled heavens, the same moon he dreaded, get that, 100 years ago. The tree they hanged Nat on is long gone to ashes. The trees he dodged behind have rotted in the swamps. The bus for Miami and the trucks boomed by, and touring cars, their heavy tires snarling on the pavement. Frogs piped in the marshes, and a hound bayed long, and yellow lights glowed from the cabin windows. That's now, of course, you know that. And as we came back the way that Nat led his army, down from Cross Keys, down to Jerusalem, we wondered if his troubled spirit still roamed the Nottoway, or if it fled with the cockcrow at daylight, or lay at peace with the bones in Jerusalem, its restlessness stifled by Southampton clay. We remembered that poster rotted through and falling, the marker split for kindling a kitchen fire. Isn't that a wonderful poem? Sorry to pass my judgment. We got quite a bit of time here. What do you respond to that any way you want to?
First of all, I think the black people in that area remembered it very well and pretended not to remember it.
Boy, that could really be historically.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. They had learned the wisdom of saying, oh, I don't know anything about that.
Yep. Yeah. That's a very good observation. And boy, does that fit historically what would have happened in the black experience in the 30s. And that goes way back to slavery time. Say, what do you think of your master? Oh, he's a good man. I get a new pair of shoes every year. I mean, and that's how they talked. And you read every slave narrative you can. And we're not talking love. I don't care what Ruth showed you or anything. They hated slavery. Every single slave narrative in existence says slavery was evil. And lines like, I don't care what the condition of the slave was, whether he's in the plantation house or out there in the field, whether he's got a good job or a bad job. They all say, I don't care what the condition of the slave is, it's still slavery. And it's awful. And so they knew, and they learned that back in slavery time. You don't speak up about that. Yeah, Nat Turner's my hero.
Yeah, right.
You know? Yeah, right. Good. Anything else?
In the story, the way she did.
And there you have it. And that's the right word. Rewrite the story. And if poets are prophets and they're about vision that's truth, the story can't be. I mean, that's what the poet does, is he unrewrites it and says, no, you've got them all mixed up. But is she deliberate about that, or is she just doesn't know? What is it?
I think it's deliberate.
Could be.
It makes her feel better, to put it this way.
Yeah, well, it sure puts the onus on Nat Turner. Mm-hmm. You know, as opposed to this black poet, Sterling A. Brown, suggesting the moon he dreaded. I mean, he wasn't out there with cheerleaders saying, let's go kill a bunch. This was no... believe, even in his deliberateness, he was not deliberate either. In fact, I think the best book written about that is by a white man. He got a lot of slack for writing it. Is William Styron's The Confessions of Nat Turner. Anyway, her lines are, right in this here house at the head of these stairs. Why? Why so? Right here. Right here.
Better story that way.
Yeah.
At that moment for her to be able to tell you that.
Yeah, that's right. And why does she want to have a better story? Why does?
Because if she can tell the story, she's the truth-telling historian.
Gives her more authority.
That's right.
Who controls the history books?
Yep.
Lots of other things.
Who tells the story? That's right. And the only access we have is this. Yeah, it's great. Okay, and then but she goes on, right here in this here. Right, I said that one. She pointed to the brick store where Nat was captured. Right over there. And we keep going. With his men around him shooting from the windows. Do you like Nat? Are you on his side? He's up there firing away. That isn't how it happened at all. They killed them all. Except for Nat. Took him in, tried it, hung him. And a couple others too.
I think it just wasn't important enough to her to care whether it was true or not. I think she was picking up bits of facts from all over the place, or stories from all over the place, and putting it into this one thing. Because it wasn't an event that meant anything.
A great assessment. And how do we know that? Absolutely. What's most important to her?
I want to make sure Nat's the bad guy.
But that's great, yes, for sure. Nat's the bad guy. We're going to establish that right now. And the things that are important to her, go ahead.
It's a peanut market.
It's a peanut market. Provided, there's nothing wrong there. Probably have a good peanut crop, goober crop, they say there. Yeah. And the visionary poet once again tells us, what do we value? What's important to us? I hope, I mean, the poet says, yeah.
Well, the thing that grabs me is the overall picture, that this, the incredible passion and injustice and everything that happened at that time just gets dissipated.
Between that and now. Because, a great point, a great observation, and it's because it doesn't matter either. What do we think is important? Not the truth. Not freedom. Not the incredible complexity of all slaves and their struggle for revolt. Historically, you might want to know, because it fits this poem, it's tangential, but it still fits it, that the white people did everything they could to keep this slave revolt, what? Quiet. Because if the slaves start thinking they can be successful, because this was for a while, and if they had more people, and they hadn't kind of given up, it's like Japan attacking us at the beginning of World War II. If they'd have kept coming, they'd have won. Well, if Nat Turner had really thought he could win, and had gathered more slaves, and the rebellion had really grown, they'd have won. Or at least they'd have made a bigger bloody mess than they did. So, but none of that matters. What matters is a goober market. Yeah, they picked it up for kindling. No signpost there anymore. My own Christian perspective on all of this stuff gets influential, but I think it fits. It isn't my imposition. It's the poets screaming out at me that say, this connects to all of the values that we see in the gospel too. That start with, sell all you have. I mean, Jesus time and again tips over all our values, completely upside down. Love me more than your brother or sister. Love, what else? Remember the great, my favorite story about the harlot caught in adultery, and they all come to him and say, what do we do? Well, the law says, and Jesus tips it right upside down and says, you without sin, you throw stones. And the visionary poets do the same thing. They tip our values and our customs and our traditions upside down, and they put something else other than goober markets up first. And one of those things that they lift up highest is, I mentioned at the beginning, the reverence for life. Anybody else? Anything? We've got, you got 3 minutes. About anything? Any more? Anything?
I just had the feeling at the end of that is how soon we forget.
Yeah.
And how history can be repeated if we aren't reminded. We could have this again.
Yep. Yep. How soon we forget. The marker split for kindling. Kitchen fire. It's gone.
She may not have been telling the truth about that either, but maybe.
Well, yeah, because that we is this group of black people that we remember the poster rotted through and falling. The marker split for kindling a kitchen fire.
Oh, it wasn't the one?
I don't think so. I think it's the we of we came back the way Nat led his army. Mm-hmm. That's the group that went with the speaker.
Right before that, an interesting little thing about what his spirit was up to. His troubled spirit still roamed in Ottawa, but fled with the cock crow at daylight.
The cock crow? Anybody? Is that an allusion? Yeah.
What current good African American poets are writing about the situation today?
Lots of them. Gwendolyn Brooks, who did the abortion thing, still does. She's old. But she's still on the lecture circuit. But she's got to be close to 80. Young ones: Nikki Giovanni, Sonny Sanchez, Donnell Lee, he's changed his name. Carolyn Rogers. I'm trying to think of Donnell Lee's name while I talk. He got rid of the Donnell Lee, the slave name, and picked up an African kind of name.
Rita Dove,
Pulitzer Prize winner.
Maya Angelou,
right. Her book, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sing, is in our bookstore. They'd love to sell it to you. And she writes, her prose is poetic. She's a beautiful writer. Richard Wright's Black Boy, he's not one of those currently, but you know, that's in the bookstore. An interesting thing that I don't know if I understand it is that there are very few male black poets, and there are even fewer male black novelists who have written really good stuff. I mean, I think if you said to somebody, name the top 10 novels in current and contemporary African-American literature, I can think of one that had been written by a man. Now, I don't know why I brought that up, but I have theories on that, but not time for that. So, yeah. Anybody else? Thank you. See you again sometime.